Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, perspectives on what's being called the most restrictive abortion ban in the nation, the new Iowa law. Slated to go into effect July 1st. We have to mention the legal challenge is trying to prevent that. Bans physicians from performing most abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected. In the first half hour, we heard details of that legal challenge. Also, we heard from lawmakers with several different views. Real sense in that last part of the segment, the strong emotions this debate entails. One of the largest medical teaching hospitals in the country is a perspective we wanted to hear. We turned to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. University of Iowa media spokesperson Tom Moore told IPR that he had not received a response from any physician willing to talk with us. And when we asked whether hospital leadership could comment on how the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics is preparing for possible implementation of this law, we were given this statement, a statement from Josh Lehman, Senior Communications Director for the Iowa Board of Regents. Let me read this. Under this law, University of Iowa Healthcare will not be able to offer comprehensive training for its obstetrician gynecology residents. This will jeopardize its accreditation with the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, the ACGME. The University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine and Iowa Obstetrics and Gynecology Department is accredited by the ACGME. And in order to receive an ACGME accreditation, the UI's Obstetrics and Gynecology Program is required to provide family planning training, including all forms of contraception, and training in the provision of abortion if the student so chooses. Limitations on abortions in Iowa would eliminate the ability to meet training requirements. End of statement by Josh Lehman, of the Senior Communications Director for the Iowa Board of Regents. Well, for the remainder of the hour, we want to put this change in Iowa's abortion law up to a historical perspective. Leslie Regan is with us, history professor at the University of Illinois Urbana, author of When Abortion Was a Crime. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you on this program. Of course, this has been contentious, I think, for a long time. We're going to get a little bit of perspective from you. We want to invite our listeners to join us with questions specifically about the history of abortions in this country. If you have anything, not the present, the history, please understand that. 1-866-780-9100. I think it's instructive, Leslie, if you would tell us about the research that went into this book and what your overall goal was before we do a sort of chronology.
Oh, okay. Well, when I began doing this research, really, I think most people just assumed it had always been a crime. It was against the law prior to the 70s when there were reform laws passed and the Roe versus Wade decisions with the Supreme Court. It had always been dangerous and hard to get. And really, we didn't know much at all about how the criminal abortion laws were enforced. And so my research was on the moment, the time when laws were passed in the 1860s and 1870s, up through Roe versus Wade, really asking a kind of simple and obvious question. Well, what happened when you made abortion illegal? Because it had been legal under common law. But what happened when you made it a crime? How were the laws enforced? Did it really stop? How did people go looking for abortions? How was it practiced? And what happened when it was made a crime? And so from that, and I was also told by many people, including archivists and historians, you will find nothing. There will be no information on this because it's shameful and against the law. But actually, when something's against the law, there were lots of records, criminal records, court records, inquests into deaths, lots of material in newspapers, medical literature, because physicians were always allowed to perform abortions for medical reasons. There was always a loophole written for them. And so That's what I did research on, was to find out what happened when it was made illegal.
It sounds like you identify the mid-1860s, mid-1800s as a place where the early laws came in. Comment quickly on before that, the time of our nation's founding, up to that time. And I get a sense from your book that this was, well, knowledge, practices that were passed from generations, mothers to daughters?
Yes. There's information passed from mothers to daughters to sisters, and there were domestic guidebooks that women would have in their families that you could buy and pass along, because women were the ones who took care of the general health care of the family. And within those are recipes and information about how to take care of all kinds of illnesses, but there would also be recipes about what to do when your menses were off, when there was a disturbance in your menstruation, and those recipes would be used to get your menses back. And that's how people talked about it. There was a disorder in the equilibrium of the body. And so those recipes, using herbs in the garden, bushes that you could find in the general area, would be used to bring order back to the body, what we would call an early abortion. But that wouldn't be the term that would have been used at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this was very common. Then there were people who sold medicines and all in the 18th century and early 19th century. As we had more newspapers and more commercial products, there were advertisements in the newspapers in the 19th century saying, if you're having trouble with your monthly regulation, do come to this doctor or midwife, and we will solve this problem. We will fix it. Or buy these Chichester's pills. You could purchase these medicines, and it would sometimes say things like, if you are about to have a baby, do not buy these. So people, of course, would understand, if that's what I'm trying to avoid, this is definitely what I want.
So was it the upswing in these the advertising of people who perform clinics, who perform abortions, that created this conservative reaction and the creation of laws?
Yeah, so under common law, English common law, there's all the early period was unregulated and sort of accepted. But at the point of quickening, when a woman could feel movement in her body, that would be understood as, life has begun. So when she could feel the kicking of the fetus. And that would depend on the woman herself, when she felt it, when she determined it. It's completely upon her sensitivity. So after that, after quickening, that was against the law, that was against morality, and there were certainly many stories of women themselves saying, they tried things. They were taking teas, they were doing hot sit baths, they were throwing themselves downstairs, and then they felt quickening and they stopped. So there would be, people could be prosecuted if they did something after quickening. Also, it was much more dangerous, of course. I mean, people might be injured or die.
Yeah.
So then the first laws, to answer your question, well, there were clinics. There was a very famous woman, Madame Ristel in New York, who was performing abortions and making a lot of money and driving around in a carriage, and that was offensive. And the people going to her were the upper-class Yankee women. And they could see that they were getting abortions, they were having a smaller number of children, smaller family size, and they were out shopping, they were involved in politics, they were demanding to get into medical schools in the 1840s and 1850s. And meanwhile, immigrants were pouring into the country. There's concerns about the Chinese, the Irish, the Catholics, how big their families are, and the leaders of this movement to change the laws really originally come out of specialists in obstetrics and the Harvard. That's what they point to. Who's going to settle our great prairies? Probably thinking of Iowa and further west. If our women don't have the number of children that they should be having. And so it really is focused on controlling their behavior, that they should be having more children. So that's why these laws are passed around the country in the 1860s and the 1870s, is to criminalize abortion from conception on.
If you just joined us, historian Leslie Regan is with us of the University of Illinois, author of When Abortion Was a Crime, giving us some historical perspective on the latest law change here in Iowa. About 10 minutes left, Leslie. Let's jump into the 20th century. Give us some 20th century landmarks on this issue.
Well, in terms of the enforcement, I mean, when we're talking about these kinds of cases, because obviously this law is intended to try to stop the practice of abortion, and I know I've read some things, so that's what the lawmakers are hoping. And certainly the long history of American history of this is the laws do not stop the practice of abortion. What it will put up are, as your earlier speakers were talking about, is creating a bureaucracy to enforce these new kinds of laws, and a bureaucracy that will specifically monitor what women are doing and monitor their bodies and monitor physicians and health personnel who are taking care of them. And we saw this earlier. So women, in terms of enforcing the law, women were not prosecuted for having abortions, very few. Mostly they prosecuted practitioners, doctors, midwives, and all the other people who got in the business to make money because there was no regulation. It was against the law. But they also interrogated women in hospitals. They got doctors to call in police or ask them themselves, who did this to you? Name the person or I won't treat you. And to ask them questions. They threatened to arrest them. And any woman who had a miscarriage, this started in the 1900s and it went right up to 1973, anybody who came in with a miscarriage into the emergency room, they questioned them. You had an abortion. Who did it? Who was the man you had sex with? How far along were you? What instrument did they use?
Up to the 1970s.
Yep. And this actually propelled some women straight into becoming very active in the movement to legalize it, became very active in Planned Parenthood or other organizations, was because of this, because of what happened to them when they had a miscarriage, was they found out how they were being treated. It also affected doctors who were not able to take care of their patients, creates a wedge between health providers and women. So it'll create those kinds of things. It also creates, if people can't get care, there's a real, you know, three-tier system of people doing it themselves, which we know already happens in states where they cannot find abortion providers or have to, you know, do 48-hour waiting periods. Poor women end up doing things themselves, cases of teenagers asking their boyfriends to beat them up. I mean, awful things.
Well, let me go back to a point you made to have you elaborate on, and I think you made a comment about the relationship between the law, more restrictive, less restrictive over time in American history on abortion, lower rates of abortion. You're saying, do you have data that indicates more restrictive laws mean fewer abortions?
Well, no, I don't think it does mean fewer.
Some would say it stands to reason if that there are people alive today because having an abortion was not as easy as it might have been.
Oh, no. Well, there may be some people who got married and had children in the 50s and didn't have an abortion. But plenty of women in the 50s had abortions, no matter how hard it was to get. So what those numbers are of who didn't, it's impossible to get an accurate number. But I can give you some estimates that there were maybe 2 million a year. There were estimates like that in 1900. There were estimates like that of over a million illegal abortions in the 50s.
How do you get data on illegal abortions?
McKinsey, well, exactly. You can't get exact numbers. But Kinsey and his studies in 1958 that found that probably a fifth of all pregnancies ended in an abortion. He found that young wives, almost a third of them had abortions, a third of their pregnancies, and separated, divorced, and widowed women, it was a very high number of their pregnancies were aborted. So there's extremely high numbers. And really what people have thought is that the number, when abortion becomes legal and the numbers are visible because they start counting them, the CDC begins counting them, really what you're seeing is the number of illegal abortions become legal and visible. Because prior to that, we have plenty of evidence of illegal abortion through through court records, through underground clinics. You know, there was an underground clinic in Chicago that was visible. It was a women's liberation clinic. They were doing, they did 11,000 abortions over a couple of years. There's an underground clinic in San Francisco that did, that sent over 12,000 women for abortions to Mexico over a couple of year period. So we know that there's huge numbers, and there's just, but even if you manage, if their goal is to manage to stop a few, the price for everybody else is, and what we know we did have prior to the legalization in the United States was hospitals like Cook County Hospital in Chicago, big public hospitals across the country, had an entire ward devoted to septic abortion cases. So 5,000 women a year in Chicago at Cook County Hospital.
Septic meaning?
Meaning infected. Possibly will die because of the infection.
Okay.
Hemorrhaged, injured. Many of those are self-induced. Some of them they've gone to somebody who doesn't do a good job. 100 every week in Los Angeles. Those wards that were devoted solely to taking care of women who were badly injured, infected, highly likely, you know, maybe they die. Don't exist anymore. We do not have them anymore in this country. And you know, in countries where it's illegal, that still exists. 25% of, and also when it was legalized, maternal mortality dropped by 45%.
It's
incredible.
5 minutes left, Leslie. Yeah. That's why I'm breaking in here. Historian Leslie Regan is with us of the University of Illinois, author of When Abortion Was a Crime. I wanted to have you take us up to Roe v. Wade. We have that tossed around in our news so much. Give us in a nutshell what was actually decided so that we can, when we're talking about overturning Roe v. Wade, we can give a little historical perspective, understanding on what that decision actually decided.
Well, Roe v. Wade recognized that the decision for an abortion was based on privacy and a decision that a woman could make with her doctor. And it saw pregnancy, it divided the decision across three trimesters. But later decisions really allowed the states to recognize an interest in the fetus. And that's what this kind of law attempts to do, is to really get away from thinking about women who are carrying a pregnancy. And that decision was rooted in exactly what your first lawmaker, the Republican, was talking about, was a movement from the 60s that really began around talking about families make these complicated decisions, and a long, long history of women and families with their doctors and their midwives thinking about what was best for them, what was best for the child, and a long tradition of Americans really morally having a moral acceptance of this practice when people reach their own conclusions based in certain situations. And also an understanding that these are private decisions. And there are religious views, and then there's the government, and separating the government from your moral and religious views. Anything that's this divided is not something we all agree upon, that the government can make a determination for everybody else. And that's really where Roe versus Wade came out of, is this long history of, I think, doctors and women working together to perform abortions and for the horrible public health consequences of the criminal abortion laws.
Do we know whether in the wake of Roe v. Wade there was a spike in legal abortions?
No, I don't think you can call it a spike. What you saw, because it was already legalized in several states. First there were reform laws, and then there was an increase in legal abortions. And what that means is when it becomes legal, there were more legal abortions done by doctors in hospitals. But there were also illegal abortions done by doctors and by people who were not doctors, who were safe and self-induced. And then it was legalized in New York in particular. It was very important because you didn't have to live in New York to get abortions there. And they had 65% of the abortions there were from out of state. They had millions of people coming in, thousands of people coming in from out of state. So that dropped the mortality level immediately. So they had a lot of clinics being set up in New York, and they were you know, helping women from all over the country and from out of the country. I mean, Canadians are coming into New York rather than going to illegal practitioners in Canada.
Let me ask, it sounds like you heard the first part of our program, the contentious words between our lawmakers there at the end of the first half hour. Compromise, finding a middle ground doesn't seem to be something, it seems to be, on this issue, have for decades been far away from it. Has that always been true in American history, that it's so divided, so contentious, so lacking in common ground or a search for it?
Yeah, thank you for asking. That's a really good question, because actually I think the first speaker also exemplified the earlier Roe versus Wade and also the earlier reform laws and the repeal in New York in 1970. Is this was not a partisan issue. Republicans and Democrats voted to change the laws and to legalize abortion. And there were Republicans and Democrats who were opposed to it. So it was not partisan in this way.
We are
in a particularly heated moment that uses abortion to talk about sexuality and family and changes in gender and race and a whole lot of other things.
Okay. Leslie Regan, unfortunately, we've run out of time. A fascinating conversation, area of study that you have. History professor at the University of Illinois. Urbana, author of When Abortion Was a Crime. Thank you for explaining some of the facets, historical facets of the abortion debate in this country and laws and so forth.
Thanks so much.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, it's a News Buzz edition of our program. Clay Masters will be joining me to talk about the candidates for governor, also that exit of Nate Bolton ahead of the June 5th primary. A former Iowa resident, John Little, will share his view of the active volcano on Hawaii. That's where he now lives. Also addressing the problem of overcrowded cemeteries tomorrow on the program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Natalia Reyes. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.